Following are comments on William Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, Act 5. A natural perspective that is and is not. The play's comic identity mix-ups are finally set right in an appropriately zany way, with one betrothal, Olivia and Sebastian, one completed marriage, Sir Toby and Mariah, and another, that of Orsino and Viola, coming right up. In Act 5, Scene 1, Antonio is trotted out before Duke Orsino as a prisoner, and this prisoner reproaches Viola Cesario, whom, of course, he mistakes for Sebastian, over the bail money he withheld. Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 71 through 73. Orsino tells Antonio he must be insane, since Viola Cesario has been his page for 3 months. Act 5, Scene 1, Line 93. But Antonio is perfectly sane, and he's infuriated with whomever he should be infuriated. Next, Olivia reproaches Viola Cesario for an alleged failure to, quote-unquote, keep promise, though of course the man who took part in the betrothal was Sebastian, not Cesario, who knows nothing about it. Act 5, Scene 1, Line 97. The Duke is still upset with Countess Olivia. Quote-unquote, why should I not, had I the heart to do it, like to the Egyptian thief at point of death, kill what I love? Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 110 through 112. He's even more upset with Viola Cesario, whom he suspects has stolen Olivia from him, since she calls the youth, quote-unquote, husband. Act 5, Scene 1, Line 136 and Line 138. True to form, though, Orsino's burst of supposedly near-murderous wrath is borrowed from an ancient Greek romance, so it has a literary cast. See the Norton editor's footnote 8 on this literary borrowing. Olivia will by no means give up her grievance against Cesario about that betrothal. And after imploring her supposed future husband, quote-unquote, fear not, Cesario, take thy fortunes up. She calls in the very curate who performed the brief ceremony. Act 5, Scene 1, Line 141. The man promptly describes what passed during the ceremony, all quite properly said and done. This revelation draws from Orsino a strong but slightly comical imprecation. Quote unquote, O thou dissembling cub! What wilt thou be when time hath sowed a grizzle on thy case? Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 157 through 158. He is ready to banish Cesario. As if things couldn't get any more confusing, in rushes Sir Andrew, calling for a surgeon to treat Sir Toby, who has been slightly injured by Sebastian. Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 165 through 170. Now the play's misrecognition dilemmas begin to resolve, since Viola Cesario is sincerely confused, not only by Olivia's claim of betrothal, but also at the accusations of violence that Sir Andrew levels. Viola Cesario asks incredulously, quote-unquote, why do you speak to me? I never hurt you. Act 5, Scene 1, Line 178. The wounded Sir Toby rails at Sir Andrew, calling him, quote-unquote, an asshead and a coxcomb and a knave, a thin-faced knave, a gull. Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 196 through 197. He seems most upset at Andrew's presumption of genuine equal friendship between them. How on earth can the mark be the equal of the grifter? There's also the fact that Sir Andrew has failed as a suitor, thereby limiting our con artist Sir Toby's prospects for continuing to turn a profit from this gullible, easygoing man. Then in comes Sebastian himself, solicitous of Olivia for his wounding of Sir Toby, and perhaps for his lateness in arriving, considering their vows. Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 199 through 204 inclusive. Orsino is astonished at the likeness between Viola Cesario and Sebastian. He sees before him, quote-unquote, one face, one voice, one habit, and two persons, a natural perspective that is and is not. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 206 through 207. Nature itself seems to have produced a miracle, often glossed, as in the relevant Norton footnote, as an, quote-unquote, optical illusion, with no need for human ingenuity. Orsino apparently means that he now beholds with wonder identical twins, both of whom he still, for the moment, believes to be young men. Just then, Sebastian recognizes his older friend and practically shouts, quote-unquote, Antonio, oh my dear Antonio, how have the hours racked and tortured me since I have lost thee? Act 5, Scene 1, lines 208 through 209. It seems that the passion, whether it suggests a classical type, platonic friendship, or otherwise, that has marked Antonio's attachment to Sebastian is not limited to the older man. Sebastian had referred to his disappointment at not being able to locate Antonio early in Act 4, Scene 3. At that point, he wanted Antonio's level-headed, quote-unquote, counsel, at line 8, regarding the seeming madness of Illyria. There is, in any case, a strong bond between the two men. But at present, what's necessary for the final clearing up of all the confusion is the introduction of gender into the chaos. Viola and Sebastian proceed to recognize each other by means of a few recollections about their father from Messaline. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 222 through 244 inclusive. The reconciliation leaves Duke Orsino and Viola and the already betrothed Olivia and Sebastian free to marry. Orsino reveals something interesting about the ongoing relationship between himself and Viola Cesario when he reminds him, quote-unquote, Boy, thou hast said to me a thousand times, thou never shouldst love woman like to me. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 257 through 258. This sounds rather courtship-like, and it seems clear that the attraction between these two was mutual from the beginning of the play, gender notwithstanding. Both have the same idea. Viola Cesario mentions that the ship's captain still has the clothes she was wearing when she reached shore, and Orsino suggests, quote-unquote, Give me thy hand, and let me see thee in thy woman's weeds. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 262 through 263. There's one last knot to untie, Malvolio's discomfiture thanks to the harsh treatment visited upon him. Feste and Fabian enter with the letter that Malvolio has penned for Olivia, and Feste reads it in the assembled company's presence, quote-unquote, By the Lord, madam, you wrong me, and the world shall know it. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 290 through 291. See 290 through 297 inclusive. At last, the man himself enters, demanding to know why he has been so dreadfully abused. Quote unquote, Why have you suffered me to be imprisoned, kept in a dark house, visited by the priest, and made the most notorious geck and gull that e'er invention played on? Tell me why. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 329 through 332. The conspirators confess, with Feste invoking, quote-unquote, the whirligig of time that, quote-unquote, brings in his revenges. Act 5, Scene 1, line 363. He also reminds Malvolio how he had slandered him to Olivia as, quote-unquote, a barren rascal, even before the insults that sparked Mariah's letter plot in Act 2, Scene 3. Act 5, Scene 1, line 362. Feste may be a fool, but he does not easily forget such a slander against his wit. The Norton vocabulary gloss for whirligig tells us that by this word, Feste refers to a quote-unquote spinning top. This is a brilliant figure for time as both a giddy thing and yet not without meaning. The head-spinning whir of events also implies circularity, and with it the possibility of time's ushering in moral recoveries and settings right, in and through those events. What Feste is invoking may be something like what today we'd call bad karma, or in a Christian context, the thriftiness of the economy of sin. Ill thoughts and deeds, as St. Augustine taught, establish their own patterns. We end up with a bitter harvest from the bad seeds we have sown. The conspirators are forgiven by everyone but Malvolio, who swears to be revenged on them all, prompting Duke Orsino to send after him to, quote-unquote, entreat him to a peace. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 364 and 366. Will Malvolio accept an apology? Well, how can we say? We just don't know. Trevor Nunn's production presents him as decamping from Olivia's great household, thence to find some new situation. Shakespeare's text, however, leaves the matter of apology and reconciliation hanging. It isn't unusual in Shakespearean comedy to leave one or more characters out in the cold at the play's end. In As You Like It, melancholy Jaques stays behind in the Forest of Arden. In The Merchant of Venice, Antonio the Merchant is constrained to give away his beloved Bassanio to the woman he loves. In Twelfth Night, another Antonio may be doing essentially the same thing with respect to Viola Cesario. Poignantly, the valiant gentleman sailor can only watch as, quote-unquote, Cesario reverts to Viola and marries the Duke of Illyria. There's also the gulled and insulted Sir Andrew, who will have to head for home with nothing to show for his mediocre efforts. All the same, Twelfth Night is hardly a dark or problem comedy. The providence that seems to guide this play is nowhere near as rough-hewn as the one we may see at work in Hamlet, where Polonius is killed by mishap, poor Ophelia runs mad and drowns, and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, quote-unquote, go to it in England. On the warm and fuzzy side, we find out that Sir Toby has married Mariah, in part from admiration of the genius of her letter plot against Malvolio. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 350 through 352. And we see that Viola agrees to wed the Duke, and Olivia has already made her betrothal with Sebastian. Feste, too, maintains his aloof perspective in this play that otherwise invites an almost giddy perspective on joining hearts. A song of his ends the play, and it would be worthwhile to consider what perspective it offers us on the action that has gone before. Quote unquote, "For the rain it raineth every day," sings Feste. And his lyrics invoke the increasing consequentiality, even of trifles, so-called, as a person grows to maturity. The quote-unquote rain gets real. The quote-unquote knaves and thieves will find themselves left out in the wind and the rain when men, quote-unquote, shut their gate. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 375 through 394 inclusive. Feste's role, that of a fool, is perhaps the only stable one in a world turned upside down. Oftentimes, the fool alone is able to maintain and offer perspective. Others in this play risk more and gain more, especially Olivia and Viola, most likely because they have sufficient inward value to begin with, and trial by experience proves and augments that value. The shallow character, Sir Andrew, by contrast, fares the worse for having ventured anything at all. Feste, however, remains the observant, wise man he already was. He is inside the play looking around, but also inside the play looking outward at us, the audience, and he seems almost to be one of us at times. The conclusion of Feste's song brings in a note of metadrama. Quote unquote, "We'll strive to please you every day," he says. Act 5, Scene 1, line 394. We can always, except in time of plague, come back to the theater, where the play realm will mediate between its own freedom and the world of time and consequence. But at that point, Feste will again remind us that soon we must leave. Perhaps then, theater is among the quote-unquote patches Feste had mentioned back in the first act. Act 1, Scene 5, lines 41 through 46. What it offers by way of insight and refuge may be temporary and partial, rather than permanent and absolute. But that doesn't mean it's of no value or not worth pursuing. The foolery in Shakespeare is seldom, to borrow a line from King Lear, in Act 1, Scene 4, quote-unquote, altogether fool. Feste and his kind are excellent embodiments of the suppleness and playfulness that constitute a big part of the value in dramatic exploration. There are certainly limits on the power of theater and of wisdom more generally, and Shakespeare does not shrink from suggesting as much. Near the beginning of Act 5, Scene 1, Orsino and Feste have a brief encounter in which the Duke pays him for wise talk wittily performed, which boils down to, quote-unquote, "So that by my foes, sir, I profit in the knowledge of myself, and by my friends I am abused." Act 5, Scene 1, lines 16 through 18. Orsino agrees to double the payment, but when hit upon to triple his contribution, he balks and suggests that Feste make himself useful by finding Olivia and sending her along. The key concern of this play, one set, at least by implication, during a time of merrymaking and reversal, may be how we, quote-unquote, fools of time, a line from Shakespeare's sonnet 124, may gain perspective. There is, quote-unquote, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, as the preacher tells us in Ecclesiastes 3:4. Everything has its allotted time and purpose under heaven. We have encountered a number of forms of stylized or excessive passion in Twelfth Night. Sir Toby's irresponsible mirth, Duke Orsino's romantic grandiosity, Countess Olivia's projected long period of mourning, Malvolio the Puritan's narrow-souled, extreme ambition and self-regard. Perhaps most or all of these approaches are attempts to deny or even annul time and consequentiality. Aside from Malvolio's selfishness, there's no need to condemn any of these attempts, other than to suggest that some styles seem more likely, to borrow a phrase from Countess Olivia, to, quote-unquote, endure wind and weather. Feste's music and witty observations invoke both the inevitability of time and the sway of our passions, and they seem to offer us the means to gain at least a semi-permanent, right-side-up perspective beyond the realms of time and passion. Shakespeare grants theater considerable regenerative power, though whether or not the result of our many comings and goings be wisdom is another question. Thanks for listening. The date of this audio recording is Tuesday, July 22nd, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations from Twelfth Night, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.